Intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled Inside the Comeback at Valley Forge by Richard Bell, the underappreciated true story of how an out-of-work Prussian military officer whipped the Patriots into shape. Most American school children have heard the story of Valley Forge. In broad outline, it goes like this. By the winter of 1777, the Revolutionary War was in its third year. That fall, the Continental Army had lost one battle after another, and the British seemed ascendant. On November 19th, thousands of bedraggled and undisciplined Patriot soldiers tramped deep in the Pennsylvania wilderness, tracking bloody footprints. A never-ending blizzard of snow, ice, and rain left these men starving and shivering in their tents. Then something miraculous happened. The straggling army, displaying grit and perseverance during the merciless winter, was whipped into shape, drilled in the art of war. The soldier who marched out of that crucible in June were transformed into a formidable fighting force. Within weeks of leaving Valley Forge, this model army would deploy its newfound skills at the Battle of Monmouth, turning the course of the war. From that point forward, George Washington and the Continental Army would never look back. Much of this story turns out to be myth, of course, the sort of irresistible, comforting mythology that seems to stick to the American Revolution like glue. More surprisingly, perhaps, is that some of it turns out to be true, or something close to it. The war was indeed at a perilous point for the Patriots by the winter of 1777. After redcoat victories at Brandywine on September 11th and Paoli on September 20th, Sir William Howe, the British commander, had led his Grand Army to winter quarters in Philadelphia, the rebel capital. Their arrival forced the Continental Congress to flee the city and seek safety in the town of York, 100 miles west. In October, Washington attacked the Redcoats at Germantown, trying to dislodge them from Philadelphia, but they defeated him decisively. Since then, the Continental Army had been bivouacking at White Marsh, north of the city, as Washington decided what to do next: encamp for the winter or take the fight to the British. On November 30th, he made the call. The Continental Army would find its own quarters for the winter. His men were in no state to mount an offensive. They needed time to rest and recover. Washington himself needed time to secure reinforcements and resupply, and the American envoys in Europe needed more time to secure critical military alliances with the continent's great powers. 10 days later, Washington announced that the army would encamp at Valley Forge, 18 miles northwest of Philadelphia. It seemed the best option available, close enough to the city to keep the British bottled up, but far enough away to see the Redcoats coming if they tried to attack. There was also decent road access to New York and New Jersey and to the mountains of western Pennsylvania if the army needed to beat a hasty retreat. The Schuylkill River, which abutted the site, would provide fresh water, and there were thousands of acres of rich farmland within foraging distance. On the morning of December 11th, 1777, the Continental Army marched out of White Marsh. It took these 11,000 soldiers and several hundred women and other camp followers nearly 9 days to cover the 13 miles to Valley Forge. Their progress slowed by rutted roads choked with mud. The site they found was not what they expected. The 2,000-acre triangle-shaped parcel was far from being a provisioner's paradise. In fact, the whole area had already been stripped bare by British foraging parties that fall. Still, the men and women in Washington's column were used to deprivation. They had already endured long months of poor supplies. It is true that morale was low and desertions were rising, but the soldiers were tough and seasoned. After each defeat that fall, they had gathered themselves up and gone back for more. They did not want for courage. The only thing that they lacked, apart from regular rations and regular pay, was the discipline and skill that comes with practice. When the army arrived at Valley Forge, the soldiers set to work constructing earth-floored log huts sturdy enough to keep out the weather. Washington wrote a memo detailing the dimensions and instructed them to lay out the huts in a grid pattern that resembled downtown Philadelphia. Soon the camp was humming with activity. Visiting Valley Forge that December, Thomas Paine said the soldiers appeared to me like a family of beavers, everyone busy, some carrying logs, others mud, and the rest fastening them all together. Within 6 weeks, the men built 2,000 log huts. According to Continental Major William Hull, in viewing it from the hills, it had the appearance of a little city. Indeed, measured by population, Valley Forge was now the fourth largest city in the rebel colonies. Up close, however, it was a ramshackle place. Most soldiers had not built wooden structures of this size before, and it showed. Archaeological evidence had revealed the hut placement also deviated from the grid plan, and a shortage of construction tools and materials frequently forced the builders to improvise. Some huts had wooden boards for roofs, others had tent cloths or turf. When the rain came, those roofs leaked, though the weather was not nearly as bad as the mythology has made out. As winters in eastern Pennsylvania go, this one, in fact, was quite mild. There were just two serious cold snaps in which mercury fell below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, one at the end of December, the other in early March. There were rain showers in January, but only 4 days of snow over the course of the entire winter. Generally, temperatures were bearable, averaging around 32 degrees first thing in the morning in December. By the end of January, bluebirds were chirping in the trees. Spring arrived in the second week of March. We know of no officer, soldier, or anyone else who even came close to freezing to death. The real killer at Valley Forge was disease. Enlisted men were packed in bunks, 12 to a hut, and slept on straw mats infested with bugs and fleas. Ventilation was poor. Washington mounted a smallpox inoculation campaign, but other diseases were harder to protect against. As the weather warmed, soldiers contracted dysentery and typhus. On January 24th, Colonel Israel Angel of Rhode Island wrote in his diary, "Three more of my regiment died last night, and this day were decently interred. It is a very alarming time amongst us as the troops are very sickly and die fast." All told, nearly 2,000 Continental Army soldiers succumbed to disease at Valley Forge, more than had died in any single battle of the war so far. Every other adversity paled in comparison, but those other miseries were no less real. Blankets, clothing, and shoes were in short supply. Contrary to mythology, no one literally went naked at Valley Forge. But British naval blockades held up delivery of uniforms ordered from France and the French Caribbean, and most soldiers went without garments that would have kept them dry and warm. Some wandered the camp in little more than hunting frocks and underwear. Others cut up tents to refashion them into shirts, breeches, or foot wrappings. During cold spells, many men used tent canvases as blankets. When it was their turn for guard duty, soldiers would try to cobble together a full ensemble from whatever items their bunkmates could lend. Still, it was not always enough. When one sentry could not find a single pair of shoes in his hut, he stood on his hat during his shift to keep his bare feet off of the cold ground. Food, too, was often dreadfully sparse. Army regulations entitled Continental soldiers to daily provisions of a pound of beef or fish, a pint of milk, and a quart of beer, along with regular rations of peas, beans, rice, and cornmeal. In practice, however, the menu was meager. Not only had the hinterland been picked over, but local farmers also preferred to sell the food they produced at market in Philadelphia, where the British paid them handsomely. and requisitioning provisions by force would only make the Army's relations with civilians worse. As food supplies at Valley Forge dwindled, malnutrition spread. The men went for days, sometimes weeks, with nothing to sustain them except rations of fire cake, a thin, tasteless patty of flour and water baked over the campfire. By February, in desperation, Washington called up supplies of salted meat from storehouses as far afield as Virginia, drawing down stockpiles intended to see the Army through the summer fighting season. He also dispatched large-scale foraging teams even deeper into the Pennsylvania countryside. Those teams succeeded in incepting British forage parties and stealing their loot. They also relieved many farmers of their provisions they were hauling toward Philadelphia. Sometimes they shot those they caught dealing with the enemy, leaving their bodies by the side of the road as a warning to others. "The inhabitants cry out and beset me from all quarters," wrote Continental Major General Nathaniel Greene after another brutalizing expedition. "But like Pharaoh, I hardened my heart and foraged the country very bare." On February 22, 1778, in the depths of that winter of discontent, a stranger rode into camp. His name was Frederick Wilhelm Ludolf Gerhard Augustin von Steuben, and he had come a very long way. The Baron, as he would become to known in America, had been born and raised in Prussia, one of the German states. Prussia was not huge, but it was mighty, and it was home to the finest military in Europe. Its Royal Prussian Army recruited its officers from the lesser nobility of the kingdom's ruling class, one of whom was Steuben. He joined the officer corps as a teenager and rose steadily over the next 17 years, reaching the rank of captain. It was a formidable education. Steuben learned soldiering from the best fighters in the world. During the Seven Years' War, he led an infantry company into combat at Prague and at Kunersdorf, and was wounded twice in the line of duty. He also trained new recruits, drilling them to fire and reload every 11 seconds, faster than any other army in Europe, and teaching them how to deliver a thunder of musket fire before charging forward in battle. Young Friedrich von Steuben was popular with his fellow officers and with the enlisted men under his command. He was also notably refined and cosmopolitan. He preferred the theater to brothels, and he read voraciously, devouring military science texts, classical literature, and everything in between. His favorite book, he said, was Don Quixote. While still a teenager, he mastered French, the language of the Prussian court. To all appearances gifted, industrious, and ambitious, young Steuben seemed on his way to a glittering career at the right hand of Prussia's warrior king, Frederick the Great. It must have been agony then when he was forced out of the Prussian army unexpectedly at age 33. Historians are divided as to why it happened. Some say it was a personal matter, others that it was a simple downsizing, and Steuben never talked about it. But the ejection left him desperate. Despite his lineage, he had no money and no land to fall back on. He left Prussia embittered and drifted around Europe for a while, trying to offer his services as a military consultant. Steuben eventually found work as a mid-level courtier for another German prince who bestowed upon him the honorific title of Freiherr, Baron, as a gift. Still, he longed to return to military duty, and in 1775 he resigned his post at court only to be turned away by both the French army and the British East India Company army. But in 1777, while staying in Strasbourg, his luck finally turned when he struck up a conversation with a man in the pay of the Patriots. Apparently, the rebels in America were looking to hire as many war-tested European officers as they could. Steuben raced to Paris to meet Benjamin Franklin and his fellow American envoy, Silas Deane. The pair had indeed put out a call for talented European officers to join the Continental Army, that they had been inundated with more job seekers than they expected. "I am well nigh harassed to death with applications of officers to go out to America," Dean told Congress a few months earlier. Some of their new hires were turning out to be valuable assets, among them the Marquis de Lafayette, Johann de Kalb, Casimir Pulaski, Tadeusz Kosciuszko, and Louis Duportail. Yet the pair found it hard to separate the wheat from the chaff, and many candidates turned out to be flops or frauds. By the time Franklin and Deane met Steuben in Franklin's rooms in June 1777, they were leery of making another bad hiring decision. No wonder, then, that Steuben's interview did not go well. Dean asked the questions and seemed interested, even impressed, but Franklin sat impassive, looking bored. He cut the meeting short and sent Steuben on his way, telling him they had no job for him. Rejected by the patrons, Steuben rushed off to another small German state, where a friend had found him a position for him in the military leadership. But the vacancy soon evaporated, the casualty of a rumor that Steuben had taken familiarities with a young boys during his service as a courtier, as John Macaulay Palmer wrote in a 1937 book about the Baron. Steuben's modern biographers doubt the rumor's veracity and have suggested that it may have been part of a political smear campaign. Still, it was a damaging allegation. Homosexuality was not an absolute taboo in 18th century Europe, even in the ranks of the armies. Frederick the Great himself was wildly rumored to be gay. But the insinuation of pedophilia was explosive, and it left Steuben jobless and heartsick. Here was another setback in what was rapidly becoming a failed career. Now he was 40, he was broke, unemployed, and seemingly unemployable. He could be forgiving for suspecting that it was a setup to a cruel joke. Then, when Franklin and Dean suddenly summoned him back to Paris, unbeknownst to Steuben, he had come to the attention of senior figures in the French War Office, among them the French Foreign Minister, the Comte de Vergennes. They persuaded the Patriot envoys to change their minds and had come up with a plan to send Steuben to America as an unpaid volunteer. Franklin and Dean would not hire him themselves. Instead, they would write him effusive letters of recommendation that members of Continental Congress couldn't consider as they decided whether to offer him a paid position. If things went as they hoped, Steuben would get work, the Continental Army would get the benefit of his expertise, and the Continental Congress would have proof that they had sympathetic senior French government officials working behind the scenes to edge France closer to declaring a formal military alliance. For this odd arrangement to work, however, those letters of recommendation would have to be superlative. Steuben was smart and ambitious, but on paper he was a nobody, an out-of-work officer for hire whose highest rank had been a captain. For that reason, his patrons in the French War Office conspired with Franklin and Dean to inflate the Baron's credentials. Their three letters to Congress all said that Steuben was a lieutenant general in the Prussian army, with more than 20 years of service under the King of Prussia. They said that he was battle-hardened, having served in every single one of Frederick the Great's campaigns. They said he had also taken on responsibility as quartermaster general for the entire Prussian army and had served as aide-de-camp to Frederick himself. They said that Steuben was in high demand across Europe and had recently turned down a very important and lucrative post in one of the German courts. All of these points were falsified, exaggerated, or misrepresented. Yet when Steuben arrived in York, Pennsylvania, 6 months later to interview with delegates to the Continental Congress, those letters did their work. It helped, of course, that the military man looked every inch the part. He was a little overweight, perhaps, with droopy cheeks and a double chin. But Steuben had dressed for the job he wanted. He wore a smart new uniform bought just 3 days earlier, and he had pinned a huge star-shaped medal to his chest, leading to his air of Prussian military nobility. The congressmen were dazzled. They quickly agreed that Steuben should proceed to Valley Forge to join the Continental Army as its newest volunteer officer, and they promised that Congress would pay all his expenses when the war was won. Steuben thanked them politely, careful not to seem too eager. 4 days later, he and the small entourage of men he had hired in Paris to serve as his personal staff arrived at Valley Forge bearing fresh letters of introduction from Congress. Steuben's presence electrified the camp. He turned out each day astride his horse in full dress uniform, his retinue at his side, and Azor, his Italian greyhound, paddling behind him. To some today, such posturing might seem pompous or ridiculous. To the soldiers, he was a wonder, and they came out of their huts each morning to watch him pass. Never before or since have I had such an impression of the ancient fabled god of war as when I looked upon the Baron, wrote a young private named Ashbel Green. General Washington took Steuben into his circle immediately, inviting him to dinner 10 times in the first 2 weeks. He encouraged the newcomer to roam the enormous encampment and report back. Steuben did just that. He took stock of the site's security and the soldiers' skills and battle readiness, and he wrote up his findings in memo after memo filled with blunt criticism and constructive advice. Having sized him up, Washington now saw the opportunity to make a transformative new hire. In March, he appointed Steuben Acting Inspector General of the Continental Army. The job made the Baron personally responsible for all matters relating to training and discipline, and Washington expected quick results. It was a weighty charge, yet Steuben was remarkably optimistic that the malnourished malcontents scattered before him would rise to the occasion. "He seemed to understand what our soldiers are capable," wrote Washington aide-de-camp John Lawrence in a letter to his father. Steuben's days in the Royal Prussian Army had taught him that drilling was the key to military discipline. Drilling was highly repetitive and often mindless, which was precisely the point. Orders could only be implemented if soldiers did as they were told, moving quickly into position along the line of battle and delivering consistent firepower. Constant regimented practice dramatically improved a unit's ability to execute these tasks. It bred obedience and broke down individuality, turning men into the components, parts of a military machine. The soldiers at Valley Forge had all drilled before, but there was no uniform system of drilling among the different colonial companies. Some had been trained using British drill manuals, others followed German or French patterns. Almost everything had been left up to the company commanders. Steuben considered that a recipe for disaster on the battlefield, the very antithesis of the Prussian system. It had been 20 years since Steuben had led a drill, but he threw himself into it, knowing that Washington's eyes were upon him. On March 19th, he lined up 100 soldiers in a field he dubbed the Grand Parade and set to work. He pulled out a sheaf of notes and began to bark instructions. Because he barked in French, however, none of the enlisted men understood a word. Lieutenant Colonels Alexander Hamilton and John Lawrence, along with the multilingual members of the Baron's staff, had to step in to translate for him. Steuben began with the basics, using a 20-man platoon to demonstrate each maneuver. First, he taught them the posture of attention, which in the Prussian army meant putting feet slightly apart, toes spread, and pressing soldiers back and chest forward. Then he went down the line to check the men's poses, correcting them, kicking ankles closer together, and tipping chins up or down as if he were arranging scenery on a stage, as his modern biographer Paul Lockhart wrote. Next, Steuben taught them the Prussian marching step. He made them do it over and over until they moved in unison, each man's heel touching the ground at the same time, 28 inches ahead of where it had been before. They marked at 75 paces a minute, much quicker than the British marching pace that some of them had learned. One man said he was marching so fast that it felt like he was dancing. Next, Steuben taught them to turn as one, first to the right, then to the left. Then he showed them how to face about so that everyone turned clockwise and reversed course at once. They paused for a break at midday. In the afternoon, the drilling resumed. He divided the men into squads to practice wheeling, forming them into lines that could arc around a single pivot like a gate swinging open. It was hard work, and each error brought down the Baron's wrath. He sputtered and swore at the most egregious mistakes, usually in French or German, though sometimes in broken English, "Gott damn, Gott damn," that left the Americans trying to stifle their smiles. That was just day one. For the rest of the week, the Baron made the soldiers review and practice the old lessons before they went on to the new. Every day, he barked more commands and stomped and cursed in different European tongues. When words failed Steuben completely, he would summon Captain Pierre de Ponceau, his 17-year-old primary translator. "My dear de Ponceau," he would growl in French, "come and swear for me in English. These fellows won't do what I bid them." Each evening, the maestro would sit in his quarters scribbling the next day's lesson plan. He was making most of it up as he went along, but he kept that secret to himself. Meanwhile, the drills began to draw attention. Crowds from other regiments turned out every morning to watch from the sidelines. After 5 days, Washington sent the model soldiers back to their companies to train their comrades. Steuben supervised it all, riding from one brigade to the next to shout instructions, feedback, and curses until the entire infantry force had been schooled in the basics of the system. "It was a continual drill," recalled Private Joseph Plum Martin. The Baron worked at a breakneck pace, aware that a new campaign could begin any day. 3 weeks in, the program was starting to bear fruit. Entire regiments now drilled together, forming columns that could wheel into battle lines on command. Steuben was swearing less and smiling more. My enterprise succeeded better than I had dared expect, he noted in a letter to Congress later that year. And I had the satisfaction in a month's time to not only see a regular step introduced in the Army, but I also made maneuvers with 10 and 12 battalions with as much precision as the evolution of a single company. By now, morale in the ranks was rising fast. Drilling together had started to breed pride, cohesion, and common cause. As Alexander Scammell, a New Hampshire officer, wrote in a letter to the Board of War, discipline flourishes and daily improves under the indefatigable efforts of Baron Steuben, who is much esteemed by all of us. At the end of April, Washington made Steuben his permanent inspector general. The designation came with an official rank, major general, and finally a substantial salary, too. On May 5th, the camp received the momentous news that the Baron's benefactors in France had finally persuaded King Louis to join the war on the Patriot side. In celebration, Washington ordered a grand review of the troops. Steuben leapt at the chance to show him what the men could do. He choreographed their maneuvers down to a last theatrical detail. After a cannon fired a 13-gun salute in honor of the 13 rebel colonies, Steuben marched the entire infantry force past their commander-in-chief to the sound of fife and drum. Their uniforms were mismatched and haphazard, but their movements were ordered and regimented. They had formed a long battle line two ranks deep. Once in position, two men on the far right flank raised their muskets and fired in the air. Then the two men to their left did the same and onward down the line. It was an elaborate display that in French military tradition is called a feu de joie, a fire of joy. When the muskets fell silent, onlookers applauded as the troops shouted, "Long live the King of France," and saluted Washington as he rode along the line. Writing to his father the next day, Lawrence was giddy. The order with which the whole was conducted, he wrote, the beautiful effect of the running fire, which was executed to perfection, the martial appearance of the troops, gave sensible pleasure to everyone present. A plan as formed by Baron von Steuben succeeded in every particular. Triumph beamed in every countenance. The training continued for the rest of May. Steuben instructed the soldiers how to march at quick step, 120 paces per minute, how to charge more effectively with their bayonets, how to rapidly reload their single-shot muskets, and how to cover retreats with volleys of fire. The training remained basic, but it was highly effective. In a matter of weeks, he transformed a collection of minimally trained, discreet detachments into a disciplined national army that might compete as equals with the British. If some of his credentials were fraudulent, the Baron was hardly a phony. And that's where we have to stop for this article today, because we've run out of time. So be sure to listen next time when we'll complete this article. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.